everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a program dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible. Sorry, kind of celebrating my birthday today, so I don't think I'm all here. I'm still out celebrating. Anyway, it's always a pleasure to be with you. And yes, it's Earth Day. It's my birthday. It's just a big day happening. And it's fun to be able to share it with you wherever you may be. I do want to let everyone know that I am returning to New York City. Yes, I will be back in the Big Apple. I venture in twice a year. And I'm going to be doing a fantastic workshop, seminar, event at the Natural Gourmet Institute, which is right in the heart of New York City, on Saturday, May 12th. That's the Saturday before Mother's Day, between 2 and 5 p.m. It's a great class. We cover lots of issues. I address everyone's questions. So the program is called Hormone Myths, Hormone Truths, Getting Your Hormones Back on Track. I hope you will make the time, if you're in the metropolitan area, to come down and visit with me, because it is a life-changing, transforming experience. Besides, it's great seeing all of you in person. So anyway, that is happening May 12th, New York City. Check with the Natural Gourmet Institute to get in on that class, and we'll all have a great time, learn, and we'll all get empowered with truthful information. So, let's see. The other thing I want to say is that I'm about to, any day now, have a new website up and running, and I'd like you to come and visit and say hello. It's whatwomenmustknow.com, but it's going to have a whole new look, a whole new feel. There will be articles, videos, as always, special reports that I send out when you opt in. So it's a place to go to get some really great information and continue educating yourself about what's really going on, particularly around issues that concern women and women's hormonal health and well-being and rejuvenation. So that's what womenmustknow.com. And for all of my listeners down under, I just want to say that I am venturing down to Australia. I will be arriving in June and staying all the way through to July. I'll be lecturing in Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Perth. So I will keep you posted. If you go to my website, I'll be listing my events, where they are and how to attend, and if anyone is listening, I'll also be going to Auckland, so I'll be over in New Zealand as well. And if anyone from Australia or New Zealand would like to organize an event, I think I probably can still fit it in, and what you need to do is just contact me, and the best way to do that is go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, or my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and send me a little message, so I'll get back to you as soon as I get that. So anyway, those are some exciting things coming up. And I am excited about the topic we will be discussing today. Oh, quite a while ago, time flies, I can't remember when, but I had a guest on my program that really inspired me, and I was actually quite impressed with what he had to say. I must say I'm one of his biggest fans. He doesn't know it, but I am. And I've invited Dr. William Davis to come and be with us again today. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Wheat Belly, which I really want to congratulate you, Dr. Davis, on Wheat Belly. It's subtitled Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. And before I introduce my guest, I just want to share a little bit about him. He's a bit of a renegade, which is my kind of person, and it takes a lot of courage for a cardiologist to be a renegade in this system. So he is very courageous, but he's speaking out, sharing his truth. He was a graduate of the St. Louis University School of Medicine and Ohio State University Hospitals, and was trained in internal medicine and cardiovascular diseases. And he also trained in advanced cardiac catheterization techniques and coronary angioplasty in the Case Western Reserve University system. And he has gone on, he has written his book, Wheat Belly. He's really making quite a big impact in the world about the wheat issue, which we're going to talk about. He's also medical director and founder of the Track Your Plaque program for heart disease prevention and reversal. And he has a book called Track Your Plaque, the only heart disease prevention program that shows how to use the new heart scans to detect, track, and control coronary plaque. And he, is also consulting for the nutritional supplement industry with an organization called, it's called Cardiology for Obesity, PPM, a consulting firm to industry and government to provide solutions to overweight and obesity issues. So it's my great pleasure to invite Dr. William Davis to the show. Hello.
Hello, and happy birthday.
Well, thank you. You know, first of all, congratulations on becoming a New York Times bestselling author. That's quite an accomplishment.
Oh, well, thank you. It's made me a lot of new friends and
a lot of new enemies.
Not so good friends.
Well, I know that it's true. I am one of your biggest fans, Dr. Davis. I've been, kind of sharing your wisdom and introducing people to your book. And I just think it's such an important book. And it's life-changing, life-transforming. And it's a big, big story. And that's why I think it's so important, because it's revealing a key piece of the puzzle that people have no awareness of. We're really so ignorant of what's going on in the world of wheat, and a lot of us don't even want to hear it, And I think we don't want to hear it because when I was looking at your recent blog, which is pretty interesting, you were talking about the fact that wheat actually is acting as an opiate. And so here's what I want to do. In today's show, I want you to go in and share some of your latest issues, concerns, findings regarding this whole wheat issue. And I also want you to spend some time talking about what you're doing with your Track the Plaque program with heart disease. I'm particularly interested in the issue of small, dense LDL particles, which I'm sure is going to be a new term to most of my listeners. But in the work that I'm doing, particularly with nutritional genomics, I'm doing a lot of testing, looking at people's specific genes, and many of them are related to their risk of cardiovascular disease. It shows up that small, dense LDL particles is a big risk factor, and your diet can actually aggravate the production of them. So people don't know what they are, they don't know what causes them, and they don't even know how to test for them. So I thought this is a great topic for us to be discussing. Does that keep you going for an hour?
I think so. A couple of days, perhaps. I'll tell you, the whole wheat free experience even continues to astound me. I've been doing this for some time, and I've done it in many, many people. But even today, I'm still learning new lessons. When you take this message to thousands of people who start to adopt this idea of wheat no longer being what we thought it was and getting rid of it, you see turnarounds in health that even astound me. Weight loss, acid reflux, irritable bowel syndrome, joint pains, leg pains, leg edema, on and on and on. An incredible array of problems go away. I would go so far as to say that a great amount of what we do in healthcare is treating wheat consumption. And as you know, it's not wheat. That is the fundamental thing for everyone to know, that what you're being sold today is the very different 2-foot-tall dwarf strain of wheat that was created in the 70s by geneticists in the cause of increasing yield to help solve world hunger. So it was done for good purpose. But you can't change, and we're learning a lot of these lessons now in the age of genetic modification, where gene splicing techniques are used to insert or remove genes. We're learning that a lot of these changes lead to all manner of unintended benefits. So we talk about things like glyphosate-resistant corn or BT toxin inoculated corn or genetically modified potatoes, and we're starting to see that experimental animal models show us that these foods distort metabolism, cause perhaps cancer, cause changes in the liver and kidneys. Well, the changes, the techniques used that predate the techniques of genetic modification, that is the less precise, less controllable techniques that were used in wheat, that is far worse techniques, generated a plant that has many characteristics different. Yeah, it's shorter, it's much higher in yield, but it's very, very different. And I think that's why we see these outsized benefits when we take it out of the diet, because it's so far different from what our moms and grandmothers had.
And we should also mention, we're not talking about GMO. This is not a GMO issue with wheat. This is how it's been hybridized for decades to change the very nature of the plant. As you said, it used to be a tall plant, and now it's kind of knee-high. And that's the issue. It's been hybridized in such a way that it really is unnatural, and it's unnatural to our bodies.
Exactly right. So this all predates genetic modification. But the techniques were pretty bizarre. They did include simple hybridization, but they also involved repeated back crossing. What that means is geneticists would repeat over and over and over, cross two strains to get a very specific characteristic, such as short height. But they also introduced genes by crossing other non-wheat plants and introducing unique characteristics. They do things like chemical mutagenesis. That is, they expose the seeds and embryos to chemicals to induce mutations, or gamma ray mutagenesis, or X-ray, high-dose X-ray mutagenesis. That is, all these techniques to induce mutations. Now, imagine you and I were evil scientists, and we did this to, let's say, the fetus in a baby chimpanzee. Well, we can't control all the mutations that occur. In fact, we might have to do that hundreds or thousands of times to even generate a viable animal. You cannot control all the many, many characteristics in these plants. So yeah, modern wheat is shorter, it's stockier, it's thicker, the seed head is bigger, the seeds look different, the hormonal behavior of this plant is different, that's why it's short. But they also changed, as you pointed out, they also changed the gliadin protein in modern wheat. There's no question, we have very thorough analyses of the gliadin protein in modern wheat. It is nothing like the gliadin protein of 1950 or 1960. We know this, and one of the pieces of evidence that this has implications for human health is, for instance, the GLIA alpha-9 sequence that's found only in modern wheat, not in older wheat, is the explanation for the quadrupling of celiac disease in the last 40 years. We know that celiac disease has quadrupled. But this new form of gliadin is also an opiate. That is, it binds to the opiate receptors in the brain, but it doesn't make us high. It just makes us hungrier. Pardon me. So consumption of modern wheat, and thereby gliadin, increases appetite. And the average person who consumes modern wheat takes in, on average, 440 more calories per day. Now, that's 440 calories more per day, 365 days per year. Mm. That's an awful lot of calories. And you know what happens if we all eat 440 calories more per day?
I mean, because it's making us hungrier, so it's driving us to eat more. Is that where the 440 calories come from?
Yes. So it's a very, very consistent and predictable. And that's on average. That includes children as well as adults. And so if we factored out kids, it's probably more towards 500-plus calories per day that we're all taking in when we consume wheat. If you take wheat, if that's true, if you take wheat out of the diet, calorie consumption should drop, and that's exactly what happens. In studies and in real life, when you take wheat out of the diet, calorie consumption goes down, on average, 440 calories per day. Now, oddly, that number, that 400 to 440 calories or so, is a very, very consistent phenomenon. We see it time and time again when you examine the data. If I give people an opiate-blocking drug to block the opiates in your brain, such as the gliadin protein in wheat, calorie consumption goes down 400 to 440 calories per day. Over and over and over again, we see that same phenomenon.
Wow.
Because this thing drives appetite. So the key, and I see this, I learned this by accident, because I took wheat out of the diet because of this issue that you raised, the small LDL particles. I took wheat out of the diet to reduce that and blood sugar. And people would show dramatic and abrupt weight loss and experience, paradoxically, a dramatic reduction in appetite. So people torture themselves. They push the plate away. They try to eat smaller portions. They try to cut their fat, try to cut their calories. They extend their exercise, and they're beating themselves up because they don't understand why they're doing all this good stuff. But they gained 12 pounds in the past year. So you take this appetite stimulant out of diet, and weight melts away, and you don't have to try.
You know, I mean, I hope this is sinking in to people when they hear this, because it's such a big story here. It's a big story. I want to ask you, I heard that the gliadin, which is the protein component in wheat, which is often what is associated with the gluten issues, is something like 8 times more than what once was. Is that a true statistic?
No, it's not. The quantity of gliadin is not that different. You know, this varies widely from strain to strain. There are 25,000. We have to generalize to some degree because there are 25,000 differing strains. Now, not to say all 25,000 are being grown in the U.S. There are only a handful of strains that dominate. But the quantity of protein, the quantity of gliadin, the quantity of gluten really hasn't changed that much over the years. But its composition has changed. And as you know, in immunology, in proteins, all you have to do is change a few amino acids. You don't have to change it a lot. You just have to shift a few amino acids, and you can change something from benign to lethal. And that's all it took, just a change of a few amino acids. Now, the great irony in this, of course, is we're told to eat more healthy whole grains. Eat more, eat more, eat more. It should be part of breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks every single day. And if you gain weight, you become overweight or obese and diabetic, it's your own fault because you are lazy and gluttonous. So that is the great irony here, that the advice given to us to eat more healthy whole grains is the cause, yet when we all suffer a downturn in health and gain weight, we are blamed for it. You can see here the incomplete understanding, the indifference, the turning a blind eye to the data, such as that from our own NIH, National Institutes of Health, that show that wheat is an opiate, has allowed the proliferation of this incredibly bad advice, eat more healthy whole grains.
And I think we need to let people know, when we're talking about how dangerous wheat is to our physiology and to our weight, we're talking about whole wheat, organic wheat, dynamic wheat, you know, whole grains, multi-grains, sprouted wheat. It doesn't really matter, right? It's, if it's made from wheat, because the original wheat that is now put into all these products is this hybridized variety.
Absolutely right. That's right. No matter what you do, if you sprout the seeds, if you don't use herbicides or pesticides and call it organic, if you use fair trade practices, if you grind it differently and using stones rather than steel rollers, no matter what, it's coming from the same semi-dwarf high-yield plant. So all the problems associated with that plant persist. And so it makes no difference. None of those changes make any difference. It remains at its foundation the very same plant. Unfortunately, it's also led to the explosion of the gluten-free notion. And that, you know, we don't want to replace one mistake, of course, with another mistake. And to replace wheat with gluten-free foods is a mistake. Because the food manufacturers, in their effort to generate such things as gluten-free multigrain bread, will use cornstarch, rice starch, potato starch, and tapioca starch as their primary flours. Now, very few foods raise blood sugar higher than 2 slices of whole wheat bread. You know, I tell people this, and they're always shocked by that, because surely the nutritionists and dietitians must be aware of this. It's buried right in the tables of glycemic index. And you can prove it to anybody with a glucose meter can prove it to themselves. So 2 slices of whole wheat bread raise blood sugar higher than nearly all other foods. The only foods that raise blood sugar even higher than whole wheat are dates, figs, and cornstarch, rice starch, tapioca starch, and potato starch, the gluten-free foods. And so the perverse ingredients used in gluten-free foods are yet another mistake. So what I'm asking people to do is eliminate wheat. Do not turn to gluten-free foods. but use foods that are naturally gluten-free. So a flour in a lot of my recipes, for instance, are ground almonds or coconut flour or other forms of ground nuts and seeds. And you can make wonderful cookies and muffins and focaccia breads. I've had a Reuben, I had recently a Reuben sandwich on my focaccia bread. It was delicious. You can recreate.
Made with almond flour?
This one was made with almond flour. I used a lot of rosemary and oregano in the mix. And it was perfect. It was a flat bread. You can have lots of good things that don't raise blood sugar sky high, that don't trigger appetite, don't trigger inflammation, etc.
By the way, I love coconut flour, and I have recipes for great coconut flour muffins and pancakes. And yeah, I think that's the important message for people, is that you can find these substitutions. You don't have to be deprived. You just have to make healthy choices.
Absolutely. And don't you love the smell of coconut flour?
Yeah, yeah.
It's that beautiful, beautiful scent. Now, about all LDL.
Yes.
So the reason I got started on this whole journey was in my practice, where I see people to help, we try to stop or reverse heart disease, that is coronary disease. And a crucial element to do that is to understand all the causes and correct everything you can, including metabolic distortions. Well, so many people have diabetes and pre-diabetes. When I meet them, so easily 80% of the people when I first meet them have diabetes or pre-diabetes. Now, part of that package, besides high blood sugars, is having an abundance of small LDL particles. So these are smaller than the conventional big LDL particles, but they're not just small. Their shape is different. Their adhesive properties are different. They're much more prone to oxidation. They live much longer in the bloodstream. A large, more benign LDL particle, for instance, persists in the bloodstream about 24 to 48 hours. Well, a small LDL particle persists about a week. So if I have a piece of pizza on Friday, I'm going to have small LDL particles for an entire week. So if I have an indulgence, a carbohydrate or wheat indulgence, once a week, I'm going to have small LDL particles all week long, 52 weeks a year. So when I took wheat out of the diet, I saw dramatic reductions in blood sugar and related measures like hemoglobin A1C, the long-term measure of blood sugar. But I also saw dramatic reductions in small LDL. I don't mean small, I don't mean 10% reductions. I mean 50, 80, 100% reductions. A typical value for small LDL, a technique I use, would be 2,000 nanomoles per liter. You take wheat out of the diet, and it drops to 200. Very, very dramatic changes or reductions in small LDL.
You know, I think for many people listening, this term, small dense LDL particles, is a new term because it's only emerging recently as a serious risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And it's a finer distinction. The categories that have been used, the LDLs, you need to get your LDLs measured, it's kind of meaningless. You have to go and get the specific form of LDL particles measured because the bigger form that you can have is not a risk factor, but if you have these small, dense LDL particles, and I'd actually like you to explain what a particle is and why it can live longer than a bigger particle. I'm curious to know what that means, Dr. Davis.
Okay. Well, they're lipoprotein particles, that is, fat-carrying proteins. So these are the transaction of energy. This is how you metabolize food. So if I eat breakfast, say, I flood my bloodstream with lipoproteins for the next 6 hours or so. This is how I absorb and process food. It's also a way to process energy. And so lipoproteins are essential to health. It's not like we don't need them. We do need them. The problem comes when we have an excess of carbohydrate consumption, especially the amylopectin A, unique to wheat. This highly metabolizable carbohydrate in wheat. So if I consume amylopectin A or sugar or fructose or other junk carbohydrates, I trigger an excess of something called chylomicrons, a form of lipoproteins. And those things flood your bloodstream and they interact with the LDL particles, the low density lipoprotein particles that are in your bloodstream. And they have a peculiar conversion and they become very small. Now, the large natural particles are well recognized by your liver, and your liver just picks them up and disposes of them. So they only live for about 24 to 48 hours. But the small LDL particles are very poorly recognized by the liver because the conformation of the unique protein in those particles, a particle called apoprotein B, is different. And your liver sees a small LDL particle and says, I don't know what that is, and lets it go past. And so small LDL particles triggered, say, by a piece of pizza on Friday stays for an entire week in your bloodstream because your liver is unable to recognize it. And so small LDL is not a little bit worse. It's a lot worse. Mm. And small LDL has exploded. I've been doing this for 20 years. And I've watched small LDL go from a problem of moderate severity in most people to a problem of incredible severity in virtually everybody. The only people I meet who don't have small LDL particles now are very slender premenopausal females who are long-distance runners or athletes. In other words, everybody, almost everybody, has small LDL. It's not uncommon for me to meet a 50-year-old woman who is healthy, and she's been eating lots of healthy whole grains, and she has a great abundance of small LDL. The wonderful thing is it's controlled wonderfully with diet. There's no need to talk about drugs. And that's why you don't hear more about it. I've been doing it for 20 years, yet it's only taken 20 years to hear this conversation, make it the most media, because the treatment is nutritional. It's not drugs. Another irony.
Not yet.
That's right.
I mean, as it gets more popular, I mean, drugs are being created for triglyceride levels. I'm sure drug companies, when this becomes more widely known or promoted, we're going to be finding that they have drugs for anything and everything.
Oh, yes.
All dense LDLs, right? But the point is, it doesn't need a drug. We don't require a drug. This is a symptom of an underlying condition driven by these high consumption of grains and sugars in our diet, carbohydrates, simple carbohydrates.
And you know the great irony also? If you don't use lipoproteins, but you use conventional cholesterol values like HDL, triglycerides, and so-called bad LDL, well, that LDL is not even a measured number. It's a calculated number. I call it fictitious LDL. Mm-hmm. And if your doctor follows fictitious LDL, it's going to lead to nonsensical ideas like cutting fat reduces LDL. It does, but it's not a real number. And it's not accurate. So if I cut the fat in my diet, what happens? HDL, the good, goes down, triglycerides go up, mm-hmm. and this calculated or fictitious LDL goes down. But if you do the lipoprotein testing, the actual measurement of the particles themselves, what you see is you do see HDL go down when you take fat out, you see triglycerides go up, you see small LDL explode. In other words, you will not see this if all you do is check the lipid panel. And in fact, the lipid panel leads you to conclusions that are the exact opposite of the truth.
You know, so we're stuck in this conundrum that we're using tests that are evaluating things that are irrelevant, and we're then being given treatments and drugs based on these irrelevant values that have serious consequences to our health, never really addressing or even investigating or assessing the real problem and the real cause.
Absolutely. And you can see these blunders, if we call them that, have made some people a lot of money. The statin drug industry alone is somewhere around $20 billion a year. So that's a pretty profitable blunder. The money made from the healthy whole grain message is quite significant. Although, by the way, optimistically, this message has prompted a 4.5% reduction in bread sales over the past year.
Oh, isn't that gone berserk. Oh, my God. You must be really excited. You're actually making a profound impact. People
think,
are hearing the message.
I think we are.
That's great. Well, listen, we need to take a break. And this is such an exciting topic. I am so thrilled that you're here, Dr. Davis. And I want you to stay put. Oh, my listeners, stay put. We're talking to Dr. Davis. He's the author of Wheat Belly, the New York Times best-selling book. And we're going to be talking about how to lose the weight, lose your hormonal problems, and lose heart disease. And we'll be right back. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are having such an important conversation with Dr. William Davis, who's the author of Wheat Belly, Lose the Fat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. And we're talking about the many facets that impact our health in relationship to wheat products, and also how it's directly impacting our heart health. And we've been discussing this little known form of LDL called small dense LDL particles, which actually is starting to get more attention, and it's directly linked to the consumption of carbohydrates and is the most dangerous form of LDL. So, Dr. Davis, do you think people should be testing their small dense LDL particles if they go in and get their lipid profile done?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of our colleagues say it's too expensive, it's inaccessible. It's actually been around for about 20-some years. The cost is a few dollars more, but it's by no means outrageous. I believe you can get there are several different techniques, but you can get it for around $80. Lipid panels are somewhere around $12, $15, $20, something like that. So it's not that much more expensive when you consider that the false information or the misleading information obtained, say, through a conventional lipid or cholesterol panel can easily lead to a $150 a month prescription for something that's not even real. So a few dollars spent up front, and probably through your insurance company, can actually shed a lot of light on what your pattern really looks like. But it leads to conclusions like, you should eat better, not you should take drugs. And in fact, I've done this now many thousands of times. We can generate far superior patterns using diet only without having to resort to drugs. One of the things I do in my practice, this is outside of my online experience and books and so on, is I consult in something called complex hyperlipidemias. These are very complicated patterns like very high triglycerides and very high cholesterol value, all that kind of stuff. I'm supposed to use lots and lots of statin drugs and related drugs like fibrates. I hardly use them at all. Yet we have great results. I haven't seen a heart attack in years. I have a high-risk practice. These are all people with prior bypass surgery, stents in past, heart attacks, survivors of cardiac arrest, sudden cardiac death. These people are supposed to be having heart attacks and repeated procedures. Nobody's having nothing. If you do some basic things, including this new approach to diet where we try to eliminate small LDL particles, I see no heart attacks. I see no deterioration of symptoms that necessitates placing three stents or going through bypass surgery. So this diet is incredibly effective. Of course, we're often told, though, by the people who are trying to help you prevent heart disease, to eat more, to cut your fat, eat more healthy whole grains. And then you and I watch that kind of advice cause small LDL particles to explode.
So let's put some of these pieces together. So we know that there's a problem with wheat because the grain itself, the hybridized dwarf variety, is causing chronic inflammation and can act as an opiate, causing people to crave more, literally as an opiate, you know, definitely causing us to want to have wheat and go through withdrawals. And the more we eat wheat and carbohydrates and the sugars and food with high fructose corn syrup, the more it's going to alter our lipid profile, creating more of these small dense LDL particles, which are the really dangerous forms of the LDL that increases our risk of heart attacks and blockages of the arteries. And by eliminating the wheat and its role in inflammation, by eliminating other carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates and sugars, which also increase the inflammation in the body, we actually are reversing the levels of small dense LDL particles and are protective to our health. Is that kind of an accurate? Is there anything else that we need to add to that picture?
Well said. Okay, that's a very accurate summary. The small LDL, I'll add, the small LDL particles are by a long stretch the most common pattern I see. I see it every single day. So it's not something that affects only a small, you know, people sometimes think if they haven't heard about it, it must be rare. Oh no, this is extremely common. it's even more common than having high blood sugars. And so if I line up 100 people, it's the rare exception who does not have it. And those are mostly kids or younger people who are just have the benefit of youth. But the vast majority of adults not only have some small LDL, they tend to have a lot of small LDL. So it's no wonder that it comes with a whole bunch of other health problems. So the high blood sugars go hand in hand. If you can't get, if someone cannot get the lipoproteins tested, one easy insight in whether you have small LDL is whether you have blood sugar problems. They're two different things, but they parallel each other fairly well. So if you've got a fasting blood sugar that's kind of high, that is above 90, or if you have a high hemoglobin A1C, that is this measure of long-term blood sugar behavior, and I call high anything above 5.0%, then you likely have small LDL particles because it means you're overexposed to carbohydrates.
So anyone dealing with metabolic syndrome, even if they're not necessarily eating carbohydrates to any degree, but are still stuck in a pattern that results in metabolic syndrome, maybe they're low in chromium. I mean, I noticed this as a pattern for myself as well. Even though I wasn't eating any more wheat, I still tended to have this insulin resistance going on. So I've had to do some other additional supplements to help get my body to respond.
Exactly right. There are mitigating, there are other factors that influence the expression of small LDL. So cortisol excess can do it, and which, as you know, it's very, very common.
Well, that's really interesting because I have a huge issue around cortisol since I see every single patient that I work with, they all have adrenal issues. They're all dealing with cortisol issues under stress. So is it stress because it impacts blood sugar modulation?
Yeah, it's almost like taking prednisone. You know how bad that is.
Mm-hmm.
So having excess cortisol, say an excessive morning surge, is really not that much different than taking a course of prednisone, which of course amplifies appetite. It blocks the activity of insulin. It causes visceral fat accumulation, tummy fat to grow. And so that's very, very important. Thyroid dysfunction, as you know, is a very incredibly common problem. It comes in a variety of forms, and that can add to the small LDL.
Can I just jump in there when you talk about the thyroid? Because about 80% of thyroid is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I previously was diagnosed with. And that is an autoimmune disease, and all autoimmune diseases start in the gut. And the gut is impaired, or what contributes to the gut being impaired is the gluten and probably the wheat. The whole wheat grain itself, so it also kind of connects more of the dots.
Absolutely, yeah. So Hashimoto's can be triggered by wheat consumption. One thing I haven't seen too much of, though, I'd like to tell you that wheat removal corrects thyroid dysfunction. I've seen that happen, but it's a little uncommon. So I think once the thyroid is disrupted by wheat consumption, it's... And usually years later you discover that you take wheat out of the diet. Only occasionally do we actually see improvement in wheat. Now we do use a lot of, I advocate use of iodine. So that's
right.
Another.
Right. Well, I want you to know I healed my Hashimoto's thyroiditis by healing my gut, removing it was gluten at the time, but now I've removed wheat. But I really did a lot of work on healing the lining of the gut and making dietary changes, and I actually don't have a problem with Hashimoto's anymore.
Excellent.
So, you know, and obviously it's best to catch these things early on.
You know, one of the things I see, a lesson that takes longer to learn with wheat elimination is the lessening of inflammatory diseases. If you go wheat-free today, most people enjoy relief from acid reflux within 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
They'll enjoy relief from irritable bowel syndrome symptoms like cramps, diarrhea, and gas within about 3 to 5 days. Joint pains in the fingers and wrists goes away within 3 to 5 days. Pain in larger joints tends to go away in a few weeks. But the diseases, the conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, polymyalgia rheumatica, lupus, all the nasty inflammatory and often autoimmune diseases, they do receive. They receive very slowly. I have a guy, for instance, who it took him 2 years to get full relief.
Mm-hmm.
I met him with disabling and incapacitating rheumatoid arthritis. He's getting the deformity of his hands and wrists. And he was on 3 drugs, including that IV drug that costs about $1,800 per month. And it was getting worse and worse, so I told him about the diet. He did it. Within 6 months, he was substantially better. Within a year, he was much better. Within 2 years, practically cured and off all drugs except one anti-inflammatory drug. Well, he made this mistake. He went on a trip to Germany, and he said, I'll be darned if I don't eat some German rye bread while I'm here, my only time to travel in Germany. He does so, and he has the worst flare-up of his lifetime. So the inflammatory conditions seem to take a lot longer to recede, but it works.
And I think people may understand the theory, but there's a part of us that just still doesn't get how wheat can actually so compromise our health. But they have to experience it. They have to be willing to give it a go, jump in, eliminate the wheat, and see how they feel. And I know in my patients, when they do that, they're astounded at how much better they feel, and then they have that direct experience where they really get to know that this food is so toxic to their body.
That's exactly my experience. And the reluctant people I remind, wheat is an opiate. No wonder it's so hard to accept that this thing is bad, because you are likely addicted to it. The people who, for instance, in my office start sobbing. They start to have panic attacks because they intuitively know this thing is addictive. And if you stop it, they're going to go through a withdrawal process. And by the way, I should mention that. I see about 35% of people go through a withdrawal process. Everyone does fine, but it may be several days and sometimes weeks of fatigue, mental fog, and a difficult time getting their job done. But you get through it and you feel better.
Why actually does that happen? What happens when you withdraw off of wheat? What happens in the brain?
I believe there's 2 reasons. I think one is the removal of this opiate. So it is a low-grade opiate withdrawal, and I think that's probably the reason for the very low mood. I've seen actually outright depression with wheat removal. But I think there's also the conversion from the rapidly metabolized carbohydrates to fat mobilization or fat oxidation, and that takes a while too. But if you get through this, well, everybody gets through it, of course, if you stick to it, you come through and you snap out of this withdrawal process, and most people tell me they feel better than they have in 20 years. And it's rather abrupt. The ending of withdrawal is rather abrupt. You can feel awful, say Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday feel like $1 million. But it's well worth it, as you know. Your experience is exactly the same as mine. That is, I have never seen such incredible turnarounds in health as I've seen with wheat elimination.
And I think we need to remind people that if you choose to go off of wheat and you're doing really well, and then you think, oh, I'm just going to have a little cracker, or I'm just going to have this one piece of bread, then that one item can actually get you hooked again. It just seems so innocuous, but actually it can get you back into that addictive cycle, and as you were saying with your patient, have amazing consequences in increasing these flare-ups and inflammation and pain, and just one piece can do that.
Absolutely. I have a name for that. I call that I ate one cookie and gained 30 pounds.
It looks so innocent, just a little cookie.
We should also mention that a lot of people have what I call wheat re-exposure syndrome. That is, when you've been wheat-free and you're doing great, and then you have something made of wheat, whether intentional or inadvertent, and about a third of the people get sick. The most common is very similar to food poisoning. It's diarrhea, cramps that can last for a couple of days. Some people get joint pains, and that can last days to weeks. Women tend to get emotional effects like anxiety, while guys get rage. So the very peculiar phenomena occur when you're re-exposed. Most common is very similar to food poisoning.
And I think we need to say that this is a really chronic problem in children. We're talking about adults, but this is behind so many of the issues. I mean, I don't normally work with children, but I've been hearing about more children, infants that have anxiety issues. And, of course, you've got the kids that got problems with allergies and asthma. This is all connected, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't take care of kids either. I have my own, of course, but I'm hearing a lot of stories from moms who are doing this with their children. It's tougher with kids, as you know. They go to school, and if they have school lunch is a terrible landmine filled with macaroni and cheese and pizza, for instance. There's peer pressure. There's birthday parties. There's sleepovers. In other words, it's a the best thing to do with kids is to educate them and let them understand why you're saying these things. But moms are telling me that they're seeing improved school performance, improved attention, decrease in behavioral outbursts. Even kids will lose the tummy, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The older kids, like the high school age kids, are experiencing improved athletic performance. So if anything, kids have more to gain than we do, but they also have a tougher job of it.
Yes, because it's everywhere in their world, everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, it's such a challenge. Why do you think there's this 4% or so drop in the consumption of wheat? Do you think it's your message? Is it the gluten-free message? Is it everything, you know, all the above?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of those two things. And we have to have solutions in place, too, and that's why I use recipes and try to educate people that gluten-free is not the solution. We cannot rely on gluten-free because we don't want to lose wheat and perhaps get relief from acid reflux and irritable bowel syndrome symptoms and joint pains, only to gain weight and become diabetic because we are eating things that have this exceptionally high glycemic index.
Yeah.
And so we've got to be smarter about foods. As you know, we cannot count on big food. We can't count on agribusiness. We can't count on grocery stores to do our education for us. We have to think for ourselves. And these are really very simple principles. And you can develop incredible health by doing these things, but you can't fall into certain mistakes, such as gluten-free.
And it's such an important point because this is beyond gluten-free. This is actually taking it to a whole new level, so to speak. Gluten-free is not good enough. I mean, that used to be, you know, a major focus for so many people, but it really is beyond gluten-free. There's another step along the way that needs to be taken to get really healthy.
Yes, exactly. I'm glad you make that point because we don't want people to hear this must be they must be talking about gluten elimination for gluten-sensitive people, and that's not me. No, this is wheat elimination for everybody. Or we should say elimination of this thing being sold to us called wheat, because it's not wheat. It's a semi-dwarf, high-yield strain, the concoction of geneticists.
Yeah.
So it's elimination of this thing being sold as called wheat for everybody.
So is there anything else that we need to know that we haven't touched on yet, Dr. Davis, that you really want to get across in our time together?
Well, in short, it's almost as if this thing was created. It was not. I think it's really a series of blunders. This thing is almost it's a perfect poison. It's a perfect thing to make you gain weight, to increase your appetite, to disrupt intestinal health and joint health, and neurological health. Even dementia has been associated with wheat. There's no organ unaffected by wheat. If you and I were evil scientists and we wanted to concoct the most damaging, hurtful thing we possibly could, we would call it wheat. This is how bad this thing is. Made worse, of course, by the advice to eat more of it. So now I remind people who are skeptical, you have the means to prove it to yourself. Do it for 4 weeks. See what happens. Now, ideally, you do it with metabolic markers, even just blood sugars and blood pressure, and measure your waist. And if you have the luxury of it, hemoglobin A1C and lipoproteins. But most people don't have access to that. So just follow the simple things. And it's a rare person who does not come back in 4 weeks and say, you know what? I was skeptical, but I lost 2 inches from my waist. My blood pressure went from 140 to 110. In other words, you'll see dramatic, life-changing turnarounds. And you don't have to submit to fancy testing to find out. You can do it yourself.
And, you know, what you mentioned that's really disturbing is that this wheat is what is grown in, I think you said 90% of the planet is using, countries all over the world are using this dwarf variety. Is that correct? Do I have that statistic right?
Yeah, it's easily 95%. It varies depending on the source. Very few farmers are growing, say, emmer wheat of the Bible, the 28 chromosome form. Very few are growing spelt and kamut or einkorn or red fife, the form that was popular in the 19th century. For all practical purposes, all wheat grown worldwide is the high-yield dwarf strength because it's such a high-yield plant. You know, if you're a farmer scratching a living out of the land and you're given a new seed that yields tenfold greater yield per acre, it's hard to blame them. Now, encouragingly, I'm getting lots of questions from farmers who say to me, well, gee, we hear what you're saying. We don't want to kill people. Should we bring back some of the old forms of wheat? Now, that's a tough thing because of the lower yield, but I'm very gratified they're even considering it.
Right. You know, when I hear that most of the farmers around the world are using this wheat, I kind of think of, gosh, could that be one of the things that's driving global obesity and, of course, increased chronic illnesses that are happening globally? And it must be a component of what's, you know, it's so profoundly compromising our health.
It fits perfectly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Everything follows. The obesity crisis in the U.S. began in 1985, and that is the precise year when all the wheat you were sold was the dwarf strain of wheat. Hmm. Yeah, it fits quite nicely.
Hmm. So in the few minutes we have left, do you have a new book out? Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, Wheat Belly,
of
course.
With recipes in it?
Oh, I'm working on that one.
Okay, so it's not out yet.
No, I'm no chef nor gourmet, but
it sounds like you like to experiment in the kitchen, a little scientific endeavor going on there.
Well, you know, it's really mostly applying common sense and not coming up with gourmet dishes, but coming up with ways to recreate, say, a pizza, mm-hmm. or how to just make a nice Reuben sandwich without all the problems, or some cheesecake or muffins. It's really not that tough. Once you get the hang of it, but it means not using wheat flour, of course, not using sugars, just using some different ingredients and techniques, and you can have some very, very nice dishes. So I'm doing that, and we should have our cookbook. The scheduled release is January 2013, so I'm in the middle of writing that right now.
And any other developments or, you know, in the impact of your message, or are you finding organizations, government, I mean, is... You know, who's listening to what you have to say?
Well, I can tell you the wheat lobby is, I wouldn't say listening, but they're well aware, and they're taking this head on. One of the wheat lobby groups has moved their offices from Boulder, Colorado to Washington, D.C. They've launched several new campaigns. They've invested a lot of money to counter these claims.
Huh.
They've called me and my followers the Wheat Belly Crazies.
Well, that's a great name. I think you should take it on board.
We had it printed on T-shirts.
I think that's great. I mean, you are a threat, and obviously this is a huge industry, and you're challenging the very nature of what they're doing. And all I can say to you, Dr. Davis, is I just really honor your courage to speak the truth because you're making such a huge difference in the lives of so many people, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I hope you come up with a beautiful, tasty, wheat-free birthday cake for you.
I will look for that one. And have a great day. Have a great Earth Day, Dr. Davis.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, we'll be speaking again. Thank you so much for being with me. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman. We've been having a really important conversation with Dr. William Davis. He's the author of Wheat Belly, Lose the Weight, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. Thank you for joining me, and remember to always honor the wisdom of feminine self. Bye for now.